You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Whose dream are we living? And I'm joined by Neil, Hannah, and Alex remotely. Just wait. So I'm going to start with Neil, if you'd just like to briefly introduce yourself.
So I'm Neil. I work for Church Action on Poverty. But I am also the convener of the Manchester and Salford Urban Mission, which is a mission partnership of the United Reformed Church.
Thank you. Hannah.
Yeah, hello everyone. I'm Hannah. I work for the Methodist Church as anti-poverty movement coordinator, and I help to coordinate the Let's End Poverty movement.
And Alex.
Hello, I'm Alex. I'm a URC special category minister, working with people at the margins of church and also a theological researcher and educator in similar areas.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to start off with our first question. Oh, sorry, I haven't introduced myself. I'm Philippa. I'm the immediate past youth moderator for the URC, United Reformed Church, and kind of program event manager in this tent, along with a whole very large team. But yes, I'll start off with the first question, which is, who is this world shaped for? So anyone can just jump in.
Oh, jumping in at the deep end. My take is the world is shaped for people with wealth and power. I'd imagine anybody at Greenbelt would kind of take that as to some extent a given. That the, you know, we live in a democracy, but a lot of the rules are made by still by the wealthy and the powerful. The media is controlled by the wealthy and the powerful. Corporations dominate a lot of what we do. Slightly more contentiously, in terms of the church, I think a lot of the decisions and priorities for the church ourselves are set by people who are relatively well and relatively wealthy and relatively powerful. We might not feel like that, but in relation to people in the communities that I know and work in, people would perceive the church as still being a powerful institution. And I think that's a topic we probably need to explore, how in terms of the church, power and decision-making is distributed.
Thank you. Hannah?
Yeah, I think we were talking about this question on the way in this morning, kind of reflecting on the questions, and you may or may not have intended the phrasing of the question to lead to some of this, but I think if we kind of take a step back, the world as shaped by God, perhaps, is for a whole variety of different beings than the world as shaped by humans, and maybe that touches on some of what Neil's just said. But we were talking on the way in about our family dog and saying who would she think the world is shaped for, and she'd very much say herself, because the world revolves around her as she lives in it. But the way that we have constructed the systems and the structures that we kind of layer on top of the world, on top of creation, I suppose, or perhaps how God intended it to be, does have a bias towards a few, towards people who are able to access power in all kinds of different ways. But I think I find it quite helpful to hold those two things in tension and not just presume that the latter is true, but that the former is true as well, and that the world as created and shaped by God is for humanity, but also for creation and all created beings, and that holding those two alongside each other can challenge us to think about why they're not the same and what we can do to make that different.
Thank you. Alex, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I totally agree with everything that's been said so far, but I think I'd add that for me, understanding kyriarchy is really important to understanding who the world is shaped for. In that, I think kyriarchy refers to multiple kind of layers of oppression that all work together. So in the same way that patriarchy is talking about the systemic power that men have, kiriarchy talks about the whole load of power structures that are related and I think informs the shaping of the world. And I think one of the things that...
He's cut out and I'm not sure...
The kiriarchy has struck back.
It has. Okay, so I'll move on to the next question and we'll jump back in with Alex as soon as he's able to reconnect. I'm not sure if it's just the screen that's frozen or what. Okay, so we're going to move on to the next question. Is it easier to identify with being on the margin as churches rather than realizing our privilege? And this question kind of was born out of the inception of church was very much radical and countercultural. So that being the inception and how the church has kind of morphed into a structure and a power that shapes society, how has that transition kind of not been understood by the members of the church who still, some people still feel very much, especially in the West, that they are marginalized as Christians, where the church is like the structural power of the church has historically been quite strong. So is it easier to identify as being on the margin or rather than understanding our privileges? Okay.
I can jump in on that one to start with. As I was reflecting on this, was thinking of a conversation that that I had. I do quite a lot of campaigning work and was in a conversation of people thinking about how we campaign around asylum and refugee rights. And somebody was complaining that we never get in the rooms with decision makers anymore. The church is never in the rooms with MPs and lords and peers and policy makers to help shape these decisions. And they were angry. And the question was, how do we get there? I remember somebody saying back, why would we want to be there at all? Why would we want to be in those spaces when actually our calling is to be with the people who are excluded from them? We are far more in the place perhaps where God calls us to be if we don't pursue those spaces and we pursue solidarity with people who are marginalized by them. And that's not to sit complacently within that kind of binary, but to recognize that it's by being in solidarity with people who are marginalized where we can encounter God's transforming power. And so I think that question of, are we more comfortable on the margins? I think a lot of the time, no, we would still kind of grasp at that, wanting to be in the room where power is, whatever that looks and feels like. And I think there has been a helpful move in recent years, and I'm sure for others for over a very long time, to think about what a church with the margins, on the margins, looks like. And that's brilliant, but I think it's still characterized by some sense of resistance that actually that's about shaping it around a dominant structure, a way of being that we're used to. And a lot of that still looks like kind of looking towards or holding on to those spaces of power. So I think there's a question for us about how uncomfortable are we willing to make ourselves from that, in order to push back on what might be our instinct that's been developed over a long time. I was going to say natural instinct, but I don't think that's true. But.
Thank you.
Yeah. Alex, bouncing off of that, mm-hmm. I feel like the church often struggles to make the distinction between being at the margins with the people who are genuinely marginalized and claiming marginalization itself. So I completely agree that I think it's really, really important that the church is at the margins, because that's where Jesus was. That's where I feel that Jesus was calling his disciples to be. And that's where the early church was. But being at the margins doesn't equate to being marginalized. And I think that sometimes the church wants to claim being marginalized, because it's really hard for any institution or individual that had power to seed it. And that what that sometimes means is that when the church tries to come alongside people at the margins, it still enacts control, and it doesn't listen to what people at the margins actually hope to see. And often that means that the people within both local churches and denominations who personally experience marginalisation struggle to have their voices heard in the church because the church isn't very comfortable with actually kind of allowing the margins to take the lead, so to speak.
Thank you. Neil?
I think the margins is sometimes the most creative space. So at Church Action on Poverty, we work with people who are experiencing marginalisation through poverty. And for the past few years, we've been doing a project exploring what it is to be a church on the margins and talking with people who are themselves on the margins about their experience of church. And what was really encouraging was the positivity that people had, the language people used about church being a place of love and family and fellowship. So people that had quite hard lives, who maybe in their communities there were not a lot of welcoming spaces, and generally society might be experienced to be quite hostile, did actually find their local expression of church to be an incredibly positive place where they could experience and give and be part of a loving community. But they also talked about the challenges of being in an institution which didn't affirm them, and the barriers to their participation around language and education and class and culture. So we put a lot of barriers in the way of people on the margins being fully part of the institution of church, which saddens me, because we could do better than that.
I definitely agree. So kind of following on from the same vein, how has the church's transition from the fringe to the core of empire and culture, particularly in the West, changed the power dynamics it has with the world and with marginalised people?
It's a very big question.
So I kind of feel like the legacies of Christendom and the place that the UK has in the church in the UK has in legislation has kind of made the church into a bit of a gatekeeper in some ways. And some of the examples I can think of is like in terms of access to food banks, in terms of inclusion and diversity, and in terms of the law. And at its best, that can mean that we're doing things like feeding people, like letting marginalized people lead, like making sure the law in the UK is just. But in reality, I feel like it often means that we are linking the ways that we feed people to evangelism, which I think is challenging in terms of its power dynamics. We are telling people where they are and where they aren't included and what the kind of limits and requirements of that are. And often in legislation, we're actually creating barriers to just laws. So I think we have inherited a kind of gatekeeping position. And although we don't always feel very powerful anymore, the church really needs to be aware of the way in which that gatekeeping it can be used and experienced in negative ways, or actually we can use it to transform things.
Thank you.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think one of the kind of things we've been reflecting on through some of the work we've done around campaigning on poverty through the Let's End Poverty movement and through other kind of pieces of campaigning that churches have done together over the last few years is how instinctively we turn towards speaking out as church collectively through perhaps people in hierarchical positions of power. The authoritative voice that we think we have comes from people who have institutional power, whether that's in the church space or, you know, for the state church, for the Church of England, for example, people who are in those rooms of power through the peers in the House of Lords. And that we might turn to that as a default way of exercising our power in the public square. But actually, is that where our power should come from or can come from within the church, and what would it look like for our collective voice on issues of justice to come from the grassroots up and to shape how we speak together collectively? What would it look like if that was shaped by people who have experience of injustice, who engage with the church at a grassroots level, to be both the people who speak and shape our collective voice as a church together? For me, that would feel a lot more authentic to who, both who we are, but also to the experiences of people who make up the church. And it would reflect an understanding of power, which I think is much more biblical, that says that doesn't just come from people who are given or granted power by hierarchical structures, but who have it by their experience and by their legitimacy of their voice as members of the body of Christ and their experience through that. And so I think we have long been used to operating in those kind of power structures that reflect empire. What would it look like if we challenged ourselves to set those aside, even if it meant we perhaps weren't listened to, and to build up power from the grassroots up, and to honour that in who we give voice and platform to as institutions, whatever that might look like.
I also think the kind of the empire model has come, we inherit it. It's not just an empire model from the past, but a model about how we engage with injustice, where the language is about us, other people doing good to other people. And a lot of the liturgy and prayer and stuff that we do around social justice starts from that point of view, an assumption that we are the people doing good and transforming other people's lives. And I think we need to push beyond that. We're not going to achieve transformation if we still think us is middle class people doing things for people that can't do things for themselves, because that's part of the problem. We need to actually flip that on its head. And this is where the margins of the creative space, where people who themselves are experiencing marginalization, set the agenda. And then we buy in and support and back that. That can be very more challenging for those of us that like to feel in control or like to do things a certain way. But actually, if you push beyond that, it's very exciting and liberating, because we don't have to come up with all the answers. If you get a group of people who are marginalized in a room, they have fantastic ideas about how they want to see things change. And that's where the genuine change comes from. And I'd say, probably if you looked at what Jesus did, that's what he was doing all the time. He was listening to and engaging with people on the margins about what their solutions are, what their view of the world, what needs to change from there. And if you look back through non-conformist tradition and history, that's where we were. I know the Methodists, you know, just across the field over there, were part of creating the trade union movement. So there is a radical tradition about the church allying with and being part of a community of people who are on the margins. But that we have to see it differently from what can we do to provide services for or food for or run projects for people. It's how can we have a conversation with people where the new ideas emerge that become our agenda for mission and transformation.
That's very profound. And I, as soon as you guys started speaking, I was just thinking about the Sermon on the Mount and kind of the flipping on the head of like power structures, you know, the meek will, you know, inherit the earth, and all of these different phrases that he used. So yeah, I'm really appreciating and really loving the conversation that's coming out. So I did want to kind of ask you guys if you guys can recall a time at the church. So this could be the institution itself or local organization, like local churches or particular members have been a good ally for people on the margins. So this would be kind of including and really embracing their ideas and allowing those ideas to shape the program. If you guys could think of examples of that.
So Church of Scotland, I'm kind of going round our ecumenical partners here. Church of Scotland 15 years ago took an incredibly radical decision, which was priority areas, so the poorest communities in Scotland, supporting and investing in those communities was the gospel priority. General Assembly said that as a statement. There was no big report, it was simple as that. Investing in these communities, investing time, money, resources, people into these communities over 10 years, over 20 years, was the gospel priority. Out of that has come some of the most imaginative ideas for tackling poverty. So the Poverty Truth Commission model, which you can hear about in the living room, I think tomorrow.
Past three tomorrow.
Came from an investment of the Church of Scotland in a programme supporting local communities. And I could talk about a whole load of other things where the church, as a big, the mainstream institution, has invested millions of pounds in communities that everybody else thinks are failing and places that have no hope for themselves, let alone for society. That, I think, was an immense decision. I'm hoping the URC is on a journey to doing the same. So I'm hoping those of you that are URC today will kind of help fly that flag.
Thank you. And I have an example, but before I give my example, I will just ask, why was it hard, or if you guys did find it hard, to think of an example of how the church has been a good ally? Why do you think that is?
I found it really hard to think of an example. And I, you know, perhaps taking my hat off of working for a national denomination here, or still holding that space. I don't think we've been very good at it at all. I think we've chipped away at it and we've done things that have made us feel comfortable. And I think the whole point of addressing these tensions, these challenges, is feeling uncomfortable. That's not going to go away just because we do the right thing, or we make the right decisions, or we prioritize the right areas. That's brilliant. But we should feel uncomfortable, because whatever we do still highlights the depth of the roots of injustice that we have been part of building up as well. And so I think that we will always struggle to be good allies unless we are willing to be uncomfortable, and to use that to fuel some radical decision-making. I think it's brilliant, that example of the Church of Scotland. And I think the Poverty Truth Commissions that have come out of that, I think, are a really good example of what good solidarity looks like. It takes time. It takes financial resource being allocated in a different way that is very countercultural to what we're used to doing, and won't be satisfying in the ways that we might have got used to. I couldn't find an example. I could find moments and glimmers of it, but not where it's been sustained. And I think that's what we need to keep pushing for, that we won't just let moments of satisfaction of feeling like we've been good allies be enough for us.
Thank you. Alex, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I completely agree with a lot of that. I do have a moment or a glimmer of when the church has been a good ally, to me, because of allowing me to let them feel uncomfortable. So I might just talk about that for a second, if that helps. So I was thinking about the Open Table Network, and it may not surprise you that I named them. I used to be a trustee of the Open Table Network. Now I'm a patron, so I do have some kind of interest in this. But the Open Table Network is a network of local church communities that put LGBTQIA plus voices front and center. And recently, the Open Table Network congregation in Cambridge was thinking about how to talk well about trans identities. And myself and Jonah, who was a young person working with us from Germany, were given the opportunity to speak about God changing names in relation to the gender recognition processes in Germany and in the UK. So Germany has just moved to a form of gender recognition that is much more just. And we were both able to speak about our own journeys and experiences of gender recognition in relation to scripture, in a congregation of people, the majority of whom had not shared those experiences. And I think having those spaces to let marginalized voices be heard in the church is really, really important. But I completely agree that that's not something that's often sustained. And also that in taking that place, and as a trans person, I've often been invited in small ways like that to be heard in the church. But you are consistently aware, as someone on the margins, being heard, making people uncomfortable, that you are making people uncomfortable. So it takes quite a lot. And I think that church would be a better ally if it was able to see that and actually tell people it's right that you feel uncomfortable. So I'm really happy that we've been talking about discomfort, because I think that the church recognizing that discomfort is a good place to be would make the experience of speaking from the margins in the church very different than it is.
Can I also give a local example, because I gave the kind of national. In the mission partnership that I'm part of, there's 9 churches. In a conventional way, most of them would be described as failing. They're small churches with small congregations, mostly elderly. A couple of them, the URC's tried to close for, you know, every other year for the past 20 years. But if you look at who those churches are partnering with, they're partnering with some amazing organisations doing amazing work. So in Moss Side, the URC Baptist Church there has a 50-year partnership with the Hideaway Youth Project. I declare an interest. I'm on the management committee of the Hideaway Youth Project. That's been working with and supporting and believing in young people from Moss Side for 50 years. And it's now working with the grandchildren of the first people that we work with. Those young people experience incredibly difficult lives. And it's absolutely essential that there's a youth project supporting them. It's not a church youth project. None of the workers are from the church. But they're young people that have been recruited from the community, and therefore understand the experience that young people are going through. They've been through it themselves. And for the church to provide a partnership and a base and the continuity for that to have existed in Moss Side for 50 years, I think is an incredible act of solidarity. But that's about being willingness that it's Hideaway doing it. It's not the church doing it. And that's where it's not always us that have to be in the lead. We have to create the space and look for the partners who are able to do this work where we're not maybe in a position to do it.
Thank you. What I really hear from this conversation is that we need to be willing to make ourselves uncomfortable and use our resources, because they often talk about, especially in the URC, with people poor, money rich, but the money seems to be very much tied up, and they're not willing, or a lot of the time people are not willing to release money to other organizations to do the work, and they know how to do the work. They're involved with the people, they're in the grassroots, and these projects are shaped by the people it's going to serve. We need to be a lot more willing to release funds and people power if we have any, and structural power if we have any, to fund and push them into these smaller organizations that need uplifting to do some like really radical work. And I just want to quickly give the example of the Legacies of Slavery project in the United Reformed Church that just passed a kind of massive, really influential resolution where they're going to be sending funds to the Caribbean to build communities, but not done by the church, done in collaboration with people who are in the community and know exactly what the people need. And it's just shaped by Caribbeans and Jamaicans rather than us kind of dictating from our high table what you need. Oh, you need that, you need that, you need that. Rather kind of allowing them to shape their own lives and shape how what their reparations look like for them. So thank you guys.
I'll just add on to that. I mean, sure. I think that's a brilliant example of actually we need to exercise our trust in God in so much of this, don't we? That what feels like letting go of financial resource or passing it on to somewhere where we might not be quite so in control of measuring the outcomes or knowing quite what's going to happen or being able to monitor them in the way that we want to see the return that we expected. Having that kind of closer hold of all of our resources isn't really exercising that trust that God works beyond us and beyond ways that we can ever imagine. But actually exercising that trust by letting go, by passing on and recognizing that God will move through those communities and those people. We need to do more of that. And, you know, I believe that by doing that, we will discover our trust in God strengthened. And so how can we practice that together as communities?
Yeah, thank you. My mic's not gone off. Okay, so we're moving on to the question, how can we be good allies? And historically, how has the church not been a good ally? So I know we've talked a lot about the times we wish they could have been good allies, how we think they should be good allies. But how has the church not been a good ally? And do you think there's ways in which that we can improve this?
I'm happy to start if that's helpful. Sorry, it's a little bit hard to read the cues in the room, so sorry if I'm jumping in unhelpfully. But I think historically and actually today, the church is often not a good ally when it doesn't listen well to the voices of those who are actually on the margins. And I think often those on the margins end up being the subject of debate and then kind of getting some crumbs under the table rather than actually being heard. And I have three examples of that really from lived experience. The first of which is LGBTQIA plus inclusion, that I think often the church, and I think there are bits of this in my own denominational context, assumes that when we get to same-sex marriage, that's the end. And LGBTQIA plus people are fully included and welcomed in the church. And as a trans person in ministry, I know personally that that's so far from being the truth. And, you know, that there's a lot of work to be done beyond same-sex marriage. And I hope that denominations who are not yet at same-sex marriage also hear that, because if a denomination makes its whole focus of LGBTQIA plus justice on one issue, then LGBTQIA plus people will continue to be marginalized within that denomination. The second example is in terms of disability. So putting in place things around disability that are recognized by the government or recognized by organizations that actually have quite a lot of power as being good enough in terms of access, but not actually listening to disabled people. And that happens even and perhaps predominantly in progressive Christian spaces. There is a reason that I'm on a screen, but that's all I'll say about that at the moment. And then thirdly, neurodiversity. So I'm often asked to speak in churches or offer training around neurodiversity. And so many times I hear people say, we are an autism-friendly church. And as an autistic person, I have to ask, but what does that actually mean? Because what it tends to mean is either we're a really, really quiet church, so autistic people will feel comfortable, or we're a really, really noisy church because we're welcoming autistic people. They don't recognize that you can't just say, oh, we're welcoming all neurodivergent people when we're all different and we're all individuals and we all have particular needs. So I think that to be good allies, churches really need to learn how to listen well to people who are at the margins. And I think that that comes back to something we were talking about earlier about the positionality, so the place from which we're listening. Because if you're listening from the perspective of we have the power to give people some things, then you're not going to quite hear. Need to listen from the position of this is going to be really uncomfortable and we are going to be profoundly changed.
Thank you.
Sorry, there we go. Yeah, I mean, just finishing off on that last word around change is exactly what I wanted to pick up on. I think we need to be willing to be changed by the process of being an ally, being in solidarity, being alongside and with people. I think sometimes we think that in our heads, but it's not really true in our hearts. And I know that from my own experience of, you know, seeking to be an ally, how often I probably should be questioning, am I going in genuinely with an openness to be changed in ways that I might not have considered? How are we doing that? And we have to remember that as institutional churches, as collective bodies, we're made up of individuals who need to take that challenge for ourselves as an individual. And am I willing to be changed by the encounter that I have with you? That actually we're not just seeking a single resolution of the injustice that we perhaps are talking about or confronting, but it's a constant process of change and transformation that we're called into by God. Are we willing to never be quite ready to close that loop or close the cycle of change in this process, but to constantly be being changed in ways that we haven't imagined? And I think the other is, I'm a bit frustrated that I am here today, because I don't feel like I hold a lived experience of marginalization to speak from. And I'm really glad to be here to join in this conversation. But we need to take the time and the care that it involves to make sure that people are given platform here and that those barriers are broken down, not just in terms of physical access to this space, but the time and consideration it takes to work alongside people to get them to a place where they can sit on a panel and be involved in the conversation. How can we be willing to displace ourselves in the conversation so that other people can have that space? Yeah, and again, that's about change, isn't it? So I think we can be a good ally by being willing to setting ourselves aside in so many ways.
I would echo all of that. The phrase we use, and the phrase that's used a lot in the Poverty Truth Commission, is deep listening. You can't do it just by a one-off conversation. It's not a consultation. It's building relationship over weeks and months and years to the point where you're friends. It's not I'm doing something charitable or, you know, beneficial for you. We're just natural friends and we know each other and we deeply know each other and deeply understand where each other's coming from. And through that, then you change. You understand the perspective of somebody. There's things that you have in common and things that are different. And things that you think are quite normal, people will then say, well, that's just not how it is for me. And there are things that people won't say until you know them for 6 months or a year. And in the end of the Poverty Truth Commission, I facilitated in Salford after 18 months. Laura, who is one of the grassroots commissioners in poverty herself, said, just casually, you're safe, Neil. And it's like what she meant, it took her 18 months to work out she could trust me. Because she'd spent too many times in rooms with professionals and middle-class people and people that wanted to do good for her and weren't really interested in listening to her. And that's a deep thing, a deep barrier to this process. Whatever kind of exclusion we're facing, people learn that we are not to be trusted. And just because we want to do good doesn't mean that we're to be trusted. And we bring with us a lot of baggage of prejudice that we have to uncover through that process and face for ourselves. And again, be willing to be uncomfortable and be challenged and be wrong and just accept we're wrong and then move on.
So finally, I want to ask, what does the church gain by sitting at the margins? So anybody can jump in right now.
I'm just going to repeat what the Church of Scotland said. It's living the gospel. This is the gospel. This is where we need to be. This is where God is. This is where Jesus was in his ministry. This is where amazing people are that have inspiring, life-giving stories that will help rescue the church and maybe, if we're bold enough, rescue society. It's not about us doing anything. It's about being humble and enter into a vulnerable, beautiful space where wonderful things can happen.
I don't think I have much more to add to that. I think, yeah, it's come up so often, hasn't it, that those creative spaces, those spaces where we are willing to be vulnerable, where we encounter God. And I think we will gain things that we won't have ever been able to comprehend. And that's the wonderfulness of being part of God's kingdom, that it's so much more than we can ask or imagine.
I agree with all of that. I think that through gaining the diversity of experiences and insights that are heard at the margins, and actually recognizing that there are people already in the church who are at the margins, because sometimes even in this conversation we're coming to that them and us speaking, which reminds us that actually even now the people at the margins within the church aren't fully heard. So gaining that experience and insight through each other. But I would also want to add to what's been said that I think we'd gain spiritual well-being. And I've experienced that personally. Control is really corrosive. And, you know, I was taught to minister as a pioneer in part by providing content and leading sessions. And I learned very quickly in pioneering that that was a form of control too. And that actually letting go of that control and just being with people and just listening to people was life-giving and has enhanced my spiritual well-being and my theological understandings. So I think if all churches and ministers, lay and ordained, were able to learn what it feels like to cede all control, then that would just be amazing for us.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you guys, for joining in this conversation, whether it's in person or on Zoom. I hope you guys have learned something, or maybe some ideas have been sparked in your imagination. Maybe you've reflected on some situations you've been in. But thank you guys for joining in this conversation. I'll repeat once again, at 4 o'clock, we have a group discussion, so anybody can join on this same topic and share their perspectives. So thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.